Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We now turn to the second half of this course. We have covered some essentials of the positive approach to understanding objectivism and how to chew it. Of course, we could multiply the issues. We could have an entire course and more than one just on what we've been doing, taking a whole bunch of other issues. We took, I think, only four or five, and there's 50 anyway. But the idea was to give you an indication of a method. And now I want to turn for a while to the negative. In other words, to errors, to basic misconceptions and wrong approaches toward understanding objectivism, or more broadly toward understanding philosophy as such. So we have a two-pronged attack, what's right and what's wrong by contrast. And the first thing we're going to do, which is our subject for this evening, which may spill over a bit into next week, is rationalism. Rationalism. Now, this is a method of approach to ideas which, more than any single other error, wrecks intellectuals, particularly good intellectuals, because it operates by corrupting them via the best within them. It attaches itself to a man's desire to be rational, to go by reason, to go by logic, to be objective. And using that, if he commits this mistake, it warps his thinking at the very root. So it, more than any other error in my knowledge, has negative effects on good people who go into the intellectual world. At the same time, it utterly alienates non-intellectuals and makes them decide that the intellectual world is a bunch of hot air, a bunch of floating talk that has nothing to do with life, that's something that gives them the creeps. And consequently, it has the effect of keeping those people out of the field altogether. So it becomes like a self-perpetuating monopoly of poor thinking. Now, rationalism is a mistaken method, a profoundly mistaken method, but it is not in and of itself evil or immoral. And I want to stress this at the outset. If it's applicable to you or your acquaintances, this is not an issue of moral default to commit this error. I think I've indicated that I wrestled with this for many years, and I have every reason to believe I was thoroughly honest in the process. Many highly virtuous people do it out of conscientiousness. It represents rationalism an automatized, imperfect way of coping with confusion. It does not reflect on your seriousness, your character, etc. Certain rationalists, certain philosophers in particular, may be dishonest. But people in this room, you're safe to say, are not. What it comes down to here is that how to deal with ideas is a special skill, which none of us are taught. And people flounder when they get thrown without any guidance into something as abstract as philosophy. Rationalism, and I may say also empiricism, are two ways of floundering, of trying to cope when you don't know how to cope. And they govern you without you even knowing that you subscribe to them. What happens is something like rationalism operates to define for you implicitly what you take as logic or understanding or reality. You don't even know that that theory is setting those definitions. And therefore, all you know is I'm trying to understand and such, just I don't understand. You're not realizing that the very concept understanding that you're using is governed by this particular theory. So you are influenced by rationalism. You follow it most often without even knowing. Now, I'm using rationalism not exactly the way the term is used in the history of philosophy. As you know, there are two broad schools in the history of philosophy, the rationalists and the empiricists. The rationalists are those who advocate reason, in essence, and derogate the senses. The empiricists are the reverse. They advocate observation and derogate reason. But as I'm using rationalism, it's a method used not only by avowed rationalists, but by most of the official empiricists in the history of philosophy also. In other words, this method of rationalism is often used unwittingly, even by people who claim to reject all the tenets of rationalism. And it's used by empiricists, therefore also those who call themselves empiricists, and it's also used very often by objectivists. Now, the best way that I know to handle this is to treat it as a syndrome, a collection of symptoms. And I'm going to, therefore, for note takers, simply enumerate to you a list of symptoms of rationalism. Number one, this would be the descriptive essence of rationalism. Ideas above reality. The rationalist regards ideas as a realm over and above reality. By reality, I mean here the physical world. He sees ideas as a private world different from reality and superior to it. Now, of course, this means he has a completely different concept of ideas than an objectivist would. He does not regard ideas as a means of knowing the world, the physical world. He regards ideas as essentially sundered from, separate from the physical world. What philosopher is the archetype, the Platonic essence of rationalism? Plato. His world of forms, or world of ideas, which is a world of abstractions existing apart from this world, far superior to this world, absolutely independent to this world, is the true philosophy of rationalism, even by people who claim, as you'll see, to oppose Plato. Putting it another way, it's a world of floating abstractions, and by floating we mean disconnected from concretes, from the things in this world. A rationalist, note, is all in favor of abstractions. He is a highly conceptual person. He likes broad abstractions. And to that extent, he has a great virtue. That's good. But he has an essential error in his view of what is an abstraction for. He doesn't see concepts, to use that terminology, as a means of grasping percepts. He sees two worlds, the worlds we perceive and the world we conceive. And concepts, thought, is entirely sundered. Now, many people have individual floating abstractions, simply by default. You know, many people on the street, for instance, have no clear idea what they mean by freedom. And if you ask them, they're all in favor of freedom, but freedom to them stands for some dissociated image like of running along the beach at night and a positive emotion and a few things like that. And they have no clear idea what in the world it means or what actual governmental measures would advance it or detract from it. That would be a single floating abstraction. And if you have just one, that does not make you a rationalist per se. That could just be a default of chewing, a failure to connect that one concept to reality. A rationalist goes beyond this. He has a whole world of floating abstractions, a whole dimension that he goes off into, made entirely of abstractions disconnected from concrete reality. Now, I don't want this to be a floating abstraction, so I'm going to give you a perfect example from an actual historical rationalist, the German philosopher Leibniz, in the late 17th century. I'll give you just a bit of his philosophy. It is entirely unnecessary to follow this step by step, nor even to know what's wrong with it. That we don't have to bother about here. It's just to get the approach to ideas. Well, Leibniz starts, or the aspect I'm going to look at, starts with the world is full of things that are compound. Like tables, rocks, mountains, and so on. By compound, he means a thing consisting of parts. Compound means just that has parts. Now, that seems very innocuous, right? Who could possibly deny a proposition like that. The world is full of compounds. All right. Well, then he goes on, and from this point, we're going to strictly see what this supposedly entails logically. Well, then, if we keep breaking a compound up, he says, that'll be broken up into parts. And if we break the parts up into parts and so on, we can only go so far, and ultimately we must reach what he calls simple substances, substances that have no parts, the ultimate parts. And we have to reach this, otherwise we'd have an infinite regress. So if there's compounds, ultimately there must be simples, things that have no parts. And those simple substances he calls monads, M-O-N-A-D, from the Greek word for one. So the universe is made up of monads. Now he's going to see what those monads would have to be like. Well, he says the first thing we can infer is that they can't possibly be material or extended, spread out, three-dimensional. Because if they were extended, then they would have to be divisible. They would have to be capable of being broken into parts, at least in thought. If they were spread out in space, even if they were only an eighth of an inch long, for instance, we could separate the left side of the monad from the right side. So that would give it, in effect, two potential parts. And it would no longer, therefore, be absolutely simple. And yet we've proved that there must be simple entities comprising the universe. Therefore, these ultimate entities cannot be extended. They cannot be material. Well, now, if they cannot be material, then they can't be in space, right? Because only material things are in space. Now, you see, we've already found out that the essence of the universe is not material, but it must have some nature, these monads. Well, what could it be? What could it be? If they're not material, what else? There's only two things that we could conceive of the ultimate elements of the universe being, either matter or mind, right? So if it's not matter, they must be minds, right? But what do minds do? You see, we're just all doing this by a process of reasoning. Minds can only ultimately be aware. Minds can only perceive things, so these monads must perceive. Well, what do these monads perceive? Well, since monads are all that exists, the only thing they could perceive is other monads. Well, if all of them are doing nothing but perceiving all the other monads, what is the difference? Well, the only two ways that a mind could differ is what it perceives and how it perceives. But what it perceives is the same, so it must be, they must differ in how they perceive. And how could they differ? Well, some of them must be clearer and others blurrier. See? Now, then we go on, and we finally reach the idea. I'm leaving out a lot of steps now. The most confused monads are what we call tables and chairs. And the clearest one is God, and so on and so. Now, you see the method here. I just give you a taste. We could go on indefinitely, and Leibniz does. But you see the method. I just give it to you in structure. There are compounds, and then entirely. If there are compounds, there must be simples. If there are simples, they must be indivisible. If they are indivisible, they must be non-material. If they are non-material, they must be non-spatial. If they are non-spatial, they must be mental. If they are mental, they must be perceivers, etc., etc. Now that is, I would like you to keep in mind, a perfect example of rationalism. It's not just one, you know, term detached from reality. It is a whole series of them, a whole world of concepts. And when you enter into it, they have definite relations to each other. It's Leibniz's world. That's his world of like Plato's. And it has a whole complicated structure and rules on how you get from one to the other. Absolutely none of it at any point connected to what we observe in this world. And if you tell him, well, look, here's a table and here's a chair and it looks material in space, he says, that's ridiculous. I've proved that if it's compound, it must be simple, etc. So all of this is an illusion. We have another world, and I get to it by this series of concepts. Now, it should be clear to you that you can do exactly the same thing with the right ideas. This is an issue of method, not of content. Leibniz happens to be what's called an idealist. He doesn't believe in matter. But you can be an objectivist and get all your ideas from Atlas Shrugged and then approach them this same way, in which case you are an irrationalist exactly the same way. Now, let's take the example that we used, I believe, last time, the type of objectivism says it's wrong ever to take money from your parents to help you in college, and see how that would be reached by this same Leibnizian or rationalistic method. And the way I've heard it is a structure like this. If there are to be values, life must be the standard. If life is to be the standard, rationality has to be the supreme virtue. If rationality is to be the supreme virtue, independence must be a virtue. But since mind-body integration is an essential metaphysical principle, therefore independence must apply both intellectually and materially. But parents, we know, are responsible only until maturity, and I am past the age of maturity, therefore taking money from them would be anti-life. See, now that is exactly the same thing as Leibniz did, only he uses more plausible ideas, objectivist ideas, but it's a whole series of inferences starting from what's supposedly an obvious foundation with no reference. This is the point to the actual situation, context, concretes at all. No reference to, is he working hard in college or not? Does he need help legitimately or not? Does he have a long-range plan or is he a bum? Do his parents have to sacrifice or not? All of those questions are simply dismissed as being completely irrelevant. He's got a series of abstractions, and then in a void, a conclusion to which they lead without any perception of concrete reality. Now you see, to give rationalism its due, there is a good element here. The rationalist wants to be logical. He's appalled at the idea of going by emotions. He wants to be objective. He wants to have proof. He's very conceptual. He loves broad principles. If there's compounds, there must be simples. If life is the standard, you must be rational. He loves that. He revels in broad abstractions. And that's good, I mean, up to a point. But the trouble is, he goes astray in his love of concepts. He goes astray because he doesn't realize what a concept is. Now, it's true that if you're going to be conceptual, you do have to be selective in your focus. A conceptual mind does have to be selective. What do we mean by selective? It has to drop out of attention while it's abstracting certain actual facts of reality. For instance, when you put together all the different tables under one concept table, you have to deliberately ignore the fact that one has four legs and one has five and one is brown and one is white, etc. You do have to drop out of attention many actual facts of reality and just focus on the common denominator. So, it is true that inherent in a conceptual mind is selective focus, actually ignoring certain elements of reality. The rationalist, unfortunately, goes one step too far. He drops reality as such. As a continuation of this same selectivity, he drops concretes altogether. Now, in a way, you cannot focus on concretes. This is what, in the nature of the mind, gives rise to rationalism. You cannot focus on concretes when you think abstractly. The whole essence of a concept is to enable you to hold a countless number of concretes without focusing on any one of them. The whole purpose of a definition is to enable us to focus on one attribute and ignore the dozens of others that the Crow epistemology couldn't hold. So we do have to ignore many facts of reality when you think abstractly. But the essence of a proper mechanism is to ignore while keeping the concretes implicit, potentially alive in your mind. The crucial necessity of proper thinking is focus selectively, drop the irrelevant facts, but always remember that they are there. They have to be capable of being recalled at a moment's notice, and your abstraction is no use except as a means of bringing you in touch with data about these concretes. But the rationalist drops the concretes and just cuts them off. He doesn't keep them potentially alive in his own mind. He enters his own world of abstractions, just like Plato's, a world of universals. Now, I think you see that you can do this very innocently by the very nature of what you do when you form concepts if you're not aware of it. And this is particularly true if you are young, you have no guidance, and you are exposed to a whole system of philosophy for the first time. You will then find that you just have a mass of ideas you cannot digest. You don't know what to do with it. They're whirling in all directions. Especially if you take a course or read a book, you'll be given a dozen definitions and 1,000 principles and 100 arguments, and it's just spinning in all directions. And you have a desperate need, many people do, to simplify, to make it graspable. And so they latch on to something that's clear to them. In the same way that Leibniz latched on to, if there's a compound, there must be a simple. That much he knows. That becomes his anchor, and then he's going to hang everything on that. Now, you see, that is understandable if you're 18 years old, plunged into a whole philosophy, including objectivism. The sheer weight of it overcomes you. So you start to deal with a floating realm of principles untied to life. That's why the only antidote to rationalism is detailed digesting in a proper way. If and when you can grasp the ideas in connection with reality, then there's no temptation to rationalism. Of course, this chaos does not have to lead to rationalism. It could also lead to empiricism, which is another type of way of remaining in control. That we'll look at next time. Well, that is our basic description of rationalism. It contains, by implication, all the other points, but let us enumerate now a second point. And that would be, if you're giving it a heading, deduction as the basic method of knowledge. Deduction. If you ask Leibniz or any rationalist, well, how do you know your conclusion is true, that everything must be a mind? Or if you ask that objectivist in the example, how do you know that you shouldn't take money from your parents? The answer will be, what do you mean? I proved it inexorably from my starting point. If this, then this. If this, then this. If this, then this. I have a whole chain, and my conclusion is therefore inexorable. Rationalists love the expression QED, quod erat demonstrandum. I proved it. This is it. In other words, their idea of what guarantees the conclusion, what validates it, what makes it incontestable, is not, well, you see that it corresponds to reality. A rationalist would never say that. What he would say is, it has been deduced. And that is, I mean, you can't beat that. That is the method of knowledge. And here again, it's deduction, not as a means of grasping reality, but as a method of connecting ideas without relation to reality. Now, of course, the contrast to deduction would be induction. Induction, which is the process of generalizing basically from observation. And a rationalist regards induction as anathema. Induction, of course, is the attempt to grasp abstractions on the basis of observing concretes, and that is the antithesis of his whole approach. He regards induction as shaky, uncertain, confusing, disorganized. It just is not deduction, and consequently, it's useless. It might be helpful, like Plato says, it's okay to engage in a little induction when you're young. to give you some preliminary ideas. But once you get the ideas, you know, you pass your baby clothes, you throw that out, and then you are just in a pure realm where you deduce one idea from another. Now, of course, we saw that these two different approaches on the topic of life as the standard. And you remember the deductive approach, which I attacked over and over, would be the idea. The way to establish life as the standard is, value is defined as that which one acts to gain and keep. By that definition, it must follow that there's something which acts to gain, there is some ultimate goal, and so it must be an alternative. Life is defined as, and then the person tries to remember, a process of self-sustaining and self-generated action. And that means, therefore, it must be the thing which alone is capable of pursuing goals and which alone is confronted by the alternative. And therefore, by those two definitions, it must fall, you see, and you deduce the whole thing with no reference whatever to the facts of reality. Now, if you ask that type of rationalistic objectivist, where did those definitions come from? There is no answer whatever. Those are just the definitions. They strike him as okay. They're in Atlas. He's got to start somewhere. And, of course, you know the crises that that leads to, the complete dissociation of those definitions from reality and consequently such problems as how do you distinguish a living thing from a statue and so on and so on. As against the way I tried to show you, the whole actual proof is not deduction but induction. It's observing actual living organisms and observing the countless differences between them and the inanimate, observing all those hundreds and hundreds of differences, and then merely conceptualizing, organizing, making explicit what your perceptions gave you. That would be an inductive approach, completely opposite of the rationalist. Now, you can put this rationalist insistence on deduction the following way. He is not concerned with the relation of ideas to facts, but with the relation of ideas to ideas. In other words, he starts with certain ideas, and then he wants to show that the next idea follows from that idea, and the next one from that idea. So his eye is always on his little world of ideas to make sure they cohere with each other, never on the relation of ideas to facts. A true rationalist carries this all the way. He is not convinced by sensory observation. He feels a need to deduce even what he directly observes. And there are many objectivists like this. Well, many, there are certainly some. They feel if you just have to look at that table and say, therefore, it exists, that's unconvincing. How do you know the senses are valid? But suppose you could give a deductive proof that the senses are valid, then you could accept the evidence of your eyes because you would have now validated it by reference to deduction. So, for instance, they'll say something like this. Science has proved that whenever we have a sensory experience, there must be an object causing our reaction. And therefore, whenever we perceive, we must be perceiving a real object. And therefore, if we perceive a table, there must really be an object there. And therefore, we can trust our eyes. Therefore, that's all a deduction, you see. Now, observe. This type of person thinks, now I can trust my eyes because I've given a deductive proof. And if you ask him, how can we rely on what science has proved if we can't trust our senses? Where does science come up with its conclusions from? That doesn't occur to him. He's now incorporated the senses in a deductive framework, and once he's done that, he's happy. So we can put the point this way. A rationalist resents the real self-evident, that is, the perceptual level. He has his own substitute for it, as we'll see in a moment. Now, you can easily see from this account deduction is the only method of knowledge. What is going to be the favorite subject of a rationalist and his idea of the model of all human knowledge? And in one word, with an M, that subject is mathematics. which has been the ideal of rationalists from time immemorial, starting with Pythagoras in the ancient world, who said all things are numbers, through Plato, who finally in his old age changed his universals into Pythagorean numbers, all the way through Spinoza, who had an ethics demonstrated what he called geometrically, just like mathematics and so on and so on. Right on through Bertrand Russell and Principia Mathematica, so it's all the way to the present. Mathematics as the paradigm of knowledge. Now, I just want to comment here on the side briefly. Mathematics is not a proper model of knowledge. It is not. Mathematics is a profoundly untypical subject. It is absolutely not typical of human cognition. It's an extraordinarily abstract subject which focuses on a single attribute of physical entities, namely quantitative relations. And in fact, you can even make a case that mathematics does not even really have a content of knowledge. It's basically a method, the way logic is. Now, the important point, though, is why a rationalist picks on mathematics. And if I put this pejoratively, it would be mathematics is the easiest subject there is. That's not a friendly description, but it's relevant to pointing out something about rationalism because the rationalist is floundering and he needs something straightforward that he can grab onto. Contrast, for instance, the typical mathematical proof with what you have to do to validate the virtue of honesty, remember, on which we spent hours and we only there touched on it. In a real cognitive situation, you have to pick out certain elements out of a vast, complicated context. You have to delimit the aspect under consideration. You have the necessity of integration facing you in dozens of directions at the same time. You have all kinds of complexities that would make your head spin to try to know what do you know and what does it rest on and what context are you speaking, etc. In mathematics, however, this is not necessary. You start off with a few delimited axioms because you're deliberately saying, I'm not focusing on reality, only one attribute, and to hell with everything else. And then in mathematics, you just churn out the conclusions from those premises. There's no traps, pitfalls, weighing of evidence, etc. And this illustrates an important point about rationalists. Rationalists cannot deal with intellectual complexity. Or they don't want to. They don't know how to. Consequently, when they begin to feel that everything is swimming, their method is to grab some abstraction, just to grab onto it, and say, that's my beacon, that's my starting point, and everything else I'm going to hang on this. Now, periodically we get letters, I'm giving you another example of this, from rationalists denouncing Christmas, denouncing objectivists for celebrating Christmas, or me for celebrating Christmas. And they are almost invariably rationalistic. They all are some variant of the idea. Christmas is the holiday celebrating altruism, where you're supposed to give gifts and do things for others, etc. Therefore, it's the opposite of objectivism. Therefore, it's immoral to celebrate. Now, what I want to point out to you here is why this is an example of a rationalist mentality. The fact is, Christmas has a great many attributes. It is not simply a holiday in which you're supposed to give gifts. There are many other things. And if you made a list, Christmas is supposed to be a time of goodwill. It's a time when you have a tree. It's a time when you have certain kind of decorations. It's a time of protracted absence of work. It's a time of office parties. It was a holiday begun by pagans and then taken over by Christians when they couldn't stamp it out. It's a time in which people are constantly denounced for being too commercial and in giving gifts not in the spirit of self-sacrifice, but simply selfishly and materialistically, etc., etc. Now, this whole chaos is true of Christmas. The rationalist, however, decides, in this case, the objectivist rationalist, there is a feature he doesn't like, and that, therefore, is it. All the rest is irrelevant, and he's going to make his deductions on that basis. Now, it's true that we do have to simplify a complexity. That's why we need definitions, in order to know what we're dealing with. So I have a valid need here. We can't deal with the complex unless we simplify it. But the whole point is the rationalist seizes arbitrarily on something that he can deal with that makes it simple and goes from there. So we have a world of ideas cemented by deduction, allegedly modeled on mathematics. Now, one corollary of this before we go to the next point. Perhaps you can see from what we've said so far, just on this emphasis on deduction, there is a strong tendency to determinism in rationalism. And the tendency comes about like this. Deduction is the proof that so-and-so must follow from the preceding, and so-and-so must follow from the preceding, etc. So a true rationalist thinks anything he's trying to explain follows of necessity from the preceding, which follows of necessity from the preceding, etc., etc. This must, in his mind, is incompatible, usually, with choice. He feels, given the starting point, the next step is inevitable, and the next, and the next, and the next, and therefore the whole thing couldn't possibly have happened differently. The perfect example of this philosophy, of the determinism implicit in rationalism, was Spinoza. Spinoza was called a logical determinist. That is, he thought that everything in the universe was determined, not by atoms or by God or by Freudian desires or anything like that. He thought everything was determined by logic itself. The sheer necessity of everything flowing deductively from the starting point meant every aspect of everyone's life had to flow inevitably from the starting points. And consequently, there was no choice at all. So you will see that there is this tendency, usually, in rationalism. All right, now let's turn to the third point. The rationalist view of the proper starting points of knowledge. And you can describe this as follows. The rationalist view is that the starting points are purely conceptual self-evidences. Purely conceptual self-evidences. Now let's develop this point. A rationalist, first of all, is very big on starting points. He thinks they are important. You have to name your starting points. You have to set them out. After all, he rests his whole case on his starting points. So he's very high on axioms. But he does not get his axioms from observation, from sensory perception. As we've seen, he resents that whole approach. So where does he get his basic self-evidences on which he's going to rest his whole deductive chain? Well, he has his own version of the idea of the self-evident. His starting points, he says, are not self-evident in the perceptual level. They are self-evident strictly on the conceptual level. In other words, they are self-evidences that you grasp only when you grasp concepts, not any way of looking at reality. You merely seize on certain abstract ideas. You say them aloud to yourself or in your mind, and it strikes you. Sounds good. Okay, obvious, common sense, incontestable, I'll buy that. Whatever it is, where there's a compound, there must be a simple. Who could deny? Okay, we start there. It just grabs you. There's no question of observing around you, and nothing like that. It's just you utter the proposition, and if it's right, it reverberates in the mind. If not, then you say, well, that's no good. I want something that just has that quality, and that then is my foundation. Now, I gave an example of this made up by Ms. Rand as a perfect example to capture the rationalist approach to action. A rationalist will say something like this. I gave this in my course on objectivism, but it's worth repeating here. A man has only two eyes, so he should see only two things, one with each eye. That would be an axiom. An eye can only see a thing. One eye, one thing. Now, that sounds okay. And then, what will follow from this will be two schools. One school will say, well, we have to accept the inference from that. Men do see only two things. Everything else is an illusion. And the other school would say, oh, that's ridiculous. We see all kinds of things, but that's because of all the hidden eyes we have. Now, this is the typical pattern. An alleged self-evident axiom, and then two schools which war with each other on the basis of it. And this is very common. One of these letters that come in periodically denouncing Christmas started with a whole series of axioms. You can tell a letter from a rationalist because they usually give four or five axioms before they get started. You know, they're deploying their foundation. And I wouldn't quote from this whole letter, but one of them, which I copied down, one of the axioms from this letter was, a holiday is a celebration of the exceptional. That was listed as a self-evident proposition. A holiday is a celebration of the exception, as against of the usual or daily or common. And the reasoning or the rationale seemed to be, well, if it was usual or everyday or some common event, it wouldn't be a celebration, and if it wasn't a celebration, it wouldn't be a holiday. Now, this sort of person, if you said to them, well, what about Labor Day? That's a holiday, and the whole idea is to celebrate something that is common and ordinary and daily and taken for granted. What about Mother's Day, etc.? This person just never thinks of that possibility. It's just, it sounds good. A holiday is a celebration of the exceptional. And it would just never occur to them to look at reality and see, is that what holidays are? I mean, you can just infer a holiday. It just strikes you. That's it. Now, that is a typical rationalist approach. Now, ultimately, since the rationalist does not get his axioms from sense perception, he has to get them from somebody else, other people. He needs some kind of authority. And so there's a tendency of rationalists to be authoritarian. When they say this is obvious, this is common sense, this is incontestable, what they really mean in the last analysis is, this is not debatable. Nobody will challenge it. Everybody agrees. So there's a definite authoritarian streak here. Sometimes it's only by implication, and the rationalist will abandon it if you point it out to him. But sometimes rationalists are openly authoritarian. The clearest example is the medieval theologians, who knew all their conclusions in advance from the Bible, and then merely concocted deductive arguments from alleged self-evident premises in order to validate what they knew in advance. Now, let me give you a different kind of example of the same rationalist approach. Imagine a group which starts a political movement on the idea that the initiation of force is evil as an axiom, as a self-evidence, as a primary. You just know that it's evil and that's it, which is basically what the libertarians do today. That's where they start. That is their equivalent of ASA. The initiation of force is evil. Now, this rests solely on authority. In this case, the authority of Ayn Rand, from whom they filched this idea. But in her, it is a late, late conclusion on about the 30th story of an entire philosophic system. But of course, for them, they just take it over. And there again, you see the need to escape any complexity, to grab as self-evident something that strikes them, that they can take in and hang everything on that. Now, the commonest form of these rationalist axioms is definitions. So that's continue of this point three. A rationalist loves to start with definitions. Now, where does he get his definitions? From the study of entities in reality? Obviously not. Definitions to him are simply a string of words equal to another word. Life equals self-sustaining, self-generated action. And wherever you have life, you could strike it out and stick self-generated, self-sustaining action. It's just one word equals other words. In other words, definitions are simply verbal. They are linguistic. They're unconnected to reality, as all concepts are. And here again, his focus is only on the relation of words to words, or concepts to concepts, not to reality. And you see again on this example why there is an authoritarian element in irrationalism. Since he doesn't get his definitions from observation, he can get it only from usage, from the way people actually use the word. In other words, from society, which becomes his authority. Now, you can do many, many things with definitions. And there, if you are familiar with St. Anselm, who was another famous rationalist in the history of philosophy, a medieval philosopher, he's kind of the extreme example of a rationalist approach to definition. Definition to him, so far from coming from reality, precede reality and give rise to it. And that is kind of the perfect rationalist approach. If you know his famous so-called ontological argument for the existence of God, he says, in effect, I'll give you this just as an example, let's start with a definition of God. We don't know whether there is one, but we're going to start with the definition. God is the being than which nothing greater can be conceived. And he says, now maybe there is no, so let's not worry about that. It's just a definition. Definitions, of course, are not related to reality, so you can just make one up. Now, he says, let's imagine that God didn't exist. Well, I could think of something even greater than that, right? Namely, something with all of his attributes, but he also existed. Now, by definition, God is the being in which nothing greater can be conceived. So he must have every perfection, including existence. Therefore, God exists. You get that? It's like, look at this. Look at these two pens, the one on my left hand and the one on my right. Now, for the people on the tape, my right hand is empty. But Anselm would argue, in effect, these two pens have every characteristic in common. They're both 6 inches long. They're both blue. They're both sharp. They both have ink, etc., etc. There's only one difference between them. The one in my left hand exists and the one in my right hand doesn't. Now, which is better? Obviously, the one in my left hand. So if the definition was the pen than which nothing greater could be conceived, it would have to be the one on my left hand. See? Now, there is an idea of words as having power over reality. Definitions as being primaries disconnected from reality, and you simply manipulate them. And periodically, something pops up as a result. And that is the perfect example of rationalism. Now, there is a corollary of this rationalist approach to starting points. This is still not a new number, but just a consequence. And that is what we can call monism. M-O-N-I-S-M. from the Greek for one, so it literally means one-ism. Monism is the view that you should really always only have one starting point, one principle. Whatever you're trying to prove or explain, the ideal method, model of knowledge is you should begin with one starting point only. And the theory here really amounts to this. Since your starting points are vulnerable, the fewer the better. The fewer you have, the less exposed you are. Ideally, therefore, if you are a full-fledged philosophic rationalist, you would like to have one insight from which everything else in the universe will follow. And that, and nothing less than that, will satisfy you. For instance, Plato had exactly that, and he called his top single supreme entity the form of the good. And when you grasp that, everything followed from that. The medievals followed Plato, but they made a god as the single thing. Plotinus had the perfect name for expressing this viewpoint. He called his supreme single principle the one. And that was it. The whole thing about the one is it's one. You couldn't say anything about it, because if you said anything about it, that would bring in two aspects. So it was just one, you see, and everything followed from that. Now there are objectivists who have definitely got this monist mentality or approach. For instance, they cannot stand the fact that objectivism begins with three axioms. Existence, consciousness, and identity. That just galls them. Why should there be three? And so what they try to do is reduce them all to just one. And the way they reduce them is to say, there's really only one axiom, the law of identity. Because if you deny existence, you're contradicting yourself. And if you deny consciousness, you're contradicting yourself. So we can really prove existence and consciousness. Therefore, we're just down to one, and that's the law of identity. Now, this, of course, is completely wrong. You cannot prove existence without taking it for granted. And if you don't take it for granted, how did you get the law of identity? What is it a law of? Etc., etc. This is completely wrong. This is an entirely rationalist attempt to prove everything but one axiom, you see. In this case, the law of identity. But the rationalist feels until he's got it down to one, there's something wrong with it. Now, I have to confess, in an early stage of my development, to having this idea. And I had it in the following form. I was going to explain this. I was young, I have to take that as a... But you see, it's the logic of the thing. Why have two starting points if you can have one? So my idea was like this. Well, history comes from ideas. Ideas come from philosophic ideas. Philosophic ideas come from metaphysics and epistemology, and they come ultimately from certain axioms or perversions of them. And ultimately, I thought you could work it out that there was only one idea central in all history, and that's the law of identity. Therefore, if a major philosopher attacks the law of identity, all the rest will follow in terms of cultural trends, political trends, economic trends, etc. Now, that is a monist, rationalist approach. And it's obvious that no one error, however disastrous, will explain everything else. It's a ludicrous construct. That's what I would call objectivist monism. All right, now let's go to point four. Now, this is a long point, which you can title Certainty with Omniscience. Certainty with Omniscience. When the rationalist has completed his deductive proof from his self-evident axioms, he claims certainty for his conclusions. After all, he says, I've given an unequivocal proof. Every step is necessitated. My axioms are not challengeable. And therefore, my conclusion is 100% certain. And this is very important to a rationalist. He cannot stand probability, skepticism. It's a matter of opinion. Who can ever know? That is simply out from his point of view. He really wants to know. He wants to have the answer, and that's one reason why he loves mathematics. Because when you prove it in mathematics, it's QED, unavoidable. But to achieve certainty, the rationalist goes on, to achieve certainty on any question, we must be completely comprehensive. We must be completely comprehensive. To put it another way, we must cover everything involved in that subject, everything, before you can claim real certainty. And one good sign of a rationalist is an obsessive need for comprehensiveness. If he is writing an article, for example, now an article has to be delimited. You can only do so much. Even a book has to be delimited, as I found to my misery when I was writing. Even an encyclopedia has to be delimited. You have to leave out a tremendous amount. But a rationalist cannot stand omitting anything. It grates on him. It goes against the grain. He feels to himself, if he omits something, well, I didn't prove my case. It isn't unanswerable. It isn't convincing. It is not absolutely certain. Now, any of you who are teachers may recognize this. I certainly have had this example. For instance, some years back, I would not have been able to do what I did in the opening lecture in this course. That is to say, there is a mind-body dichotomy. I'm going to only look at three forms of it, even though there are 22 others. That would have killed me. I couldn't have left out 19. Of course, it would have been extremely perverse to give 22. You could never have held it all. From the Crow epistemology, it would have been too many units to hold. But the idea would be, well, if you just touch on three, you're leaving out all the 19. You're missing out most of the key elements in the subject. You just aren't making it clear. Now, this can apply in teaching, it can apply in writing, it can apply in thinking. In thinking, it takes the form. If any one point is not fully clear to you, your certainty about the entire issue is undermined. If any one point is unclear to you, your certainty about the entire issue is destroyed. It's the idea, therefore, you must know everything to really know anything about a given issue. That's the title, Certainty with Omniscience. Now, what would explain this rationalist need for comprehensiveness, for omniscience, for constantly covering everything? Which is essential to his approach. This is not a variable issue. It's true of all rationalists. Well, it has to do with the way he holds abstractions in his mind. It's an unavoidable consequence of his wrong way of holding abstractions. It's because he holds abstractions as floating and detached from reality. His abstractions, as we've said, do not stand in his mind as integrations of concretes, but as ideas in another dimension unrelated to concretes. The unavoidable result of that is the feeling, however wonderful your theory, however wonderful your principles and your abstractions, they somehow miss out reality. They leave out issues, topics, facts of the world, of actual real life. And therefore, the only way to cover reality, since you can't do it by concepts, is what? in effect, a concrete-by-concrete survey over and above your broad abstractions. In other words, the aim for comprehensiveness is really a desire to do on the perceptual level by constant accumulation of concretes what he cannot do on the conceptual level because his concepts don't stand as integrations of concretes. Let me give you the same point in slightly different terms. Concepts are functioning in his mind improperly. Abstract arguments, therefore, are simply not convincing to him. They're vague, generalized, empty. He feels that they're vague, generalized, empty, and he's right. As they stand in his mind, they are vague, generalized, and empty. Consequently, he feels he has to make up the deficit. And the only way he knows, since he can't do it by abstract concepts, is to plunge in and go over every detail of the territory. Try to take every little aspect or point of the topic and say, you see, I can deal with that. Oh, so that makes it more convincing. And I can deal with that. That makes it more convincing. And I can deal with that, etc., etc. And consequently, he is absolutely unable to delimit any topic in his own mind. For instance, take honesty as the example. Now, the way we did it is to discuss it in abstract principle. But the principle was chewed with a few examples, the specification of the context, the definition, etc. And we were able to say, we understand this now, no matter what example comes, because we see the relation of the principle to reality. There were many, many things, though, that we didn't discuss, but we didn't have to. And we didn't have to feel, well, we're not really sure, because the principle, as far as we went with it, was related to reality. But now a rationalist, approaching honesty, let's say, would hear the abstract argument. And he would feel, yes, that's fine. I like abstractions. But at the same time, it's not enough. It just doesn't convince all by itself. He feels, well, there's so many things about honesty I don't yet see. And any one of them threatens my broad principle because my principle, he knows, is somehow floating. So he has this need. Let's jump in. Let's take every possible question about honesty that you could dredge up. We have to know everything. And of course, if you're going to try to know everything about any one thing, you have to know everything about everything. He can't delimit. As soon as you say honesty, yeah, I see it in theory, but what about the used car salesman? I don't see how it would apply. What about white lies? What about social lies? What about if you're a doctor and you have a patient who's sick? How sick does he have to be? What diseases? And there's hundreds and thousands of questions that flood into his mind with the feeling, until I know all this, I don't understand honesty. Now, the correct approach, of course, is to stay away from those examples like the plague, as we did. Take the simple examples to grasp the principle and then use the principle, if and when necessary, to untangle some of these complexities. But the rationalist can't do that. For him, the principle is simply a floating generality, and in his mind it is. So he has to supplement it by grabbing every concrete form of lie and studying that particular one as well as he can, and it becomes an endless process of multiplying. And if he leaves one out, he feels, I'm not being conscientious. I don't really understand. I don't know the answer to the next example. I have to write a whole volume on honesty, and even then, I just scratch the surface because every example brings up 10,000 other concepts that I don't really understand, and those to others, and pretty soon, it's the typical rationalist syndrome. The thing sprawls everywhere, and he feels he can know nothing. (sighs) Now, there's another aspect involved in this point of certainty with omniscience. A very important consequence of his approach, still the same number. We've said that the rationalist ends up trying to do on the perceptual, concrete level, what he can't do by means of abstractions. He's reduced to a kind of enormously detailed, concrete by concrete survey without benefit of broad abstractions. Well, now the question becomes, how can he do this? How can you hope to know all of these concretes without abstractions? How can you deal with these thousand examples of honesty without abstractions? Obviously, you cannot. The whole idea of an abstraction is to enable us to put an endless number of concretes together into a unit. Without those, we would just be swamped. The crow epistemology would make us expire. We'd look at five examples and our mind would just wipe itself out. Now, the rationalist is in this exact position. He throws out abstractions when he wants to be absolutely certain. He starts studying all the examples, but he feels completely swamped by all those examples. He feels the tremendous pressure of how am I going to deal with them? And his solution is, what do you think his solution is? Now, if you guess wrong, you'll throw everybody up. His solution is, this is just too much to deal with. So, for now, I'm going to focus on just one example and forget everything else. I'm going to ignore all the other examples. I'm going to take just one detail, one topic, one point. And I'm going to, on principle, say to hell with all the rest of it. I'm just going to study that one until I really, really get it. Until I'm completely satisfied. And then when I got that, tomorrow I'll take the next one. And I'll work just on that until I really have that, and so on. Of course, he has one problem with this. What's the problem? How does he get one? How does he really grasp it without concepts? The only way you can grasp what's wrong, for instance, with white lies is by reference to the principle of honesty. But he decides that's too vague. Now we're going to study white lies as a special subject. I'm going to really get that before we look at black lies. See? So now he's going to study just white lies, but how can he do it? Well, he feels white lies is a huge subject. There's so many different kinds of white lies for so many different motives, for so many different people. Well, maybe white lies is too broad a subject. Maybe we should study just white lies told for close relatives. And of course, that doesn't work. And so it gets more and more concrete, or put it another way, more and more disintegrated. He takes a stab at white lies for close relatives, and then a stab at used car salesmen with Chevrolets, and etc., and so on. And if you tell him, you're not getting anywhere this way, you've got a whole bunch of disconnected items, none of them prove anything, because you haven't connected it all and seen the principled overview, he feels, oh no, you're just taking me back into this world of generalities, and I've got to know everything. So, he is, in effect, in a world of disconnected concretes on principle. On principle, as a means of trying to become omniscient. And that approach we call compartmentalization. That's a huge word. Compartmentalization. Now, basically, compartmentalization, it's a horrible word because it violates the crow epistemology. It's so long, you can't hold it in one mind. Compartmentalization is basically antagonism on principle to integration. It's deliberate disintegration. In other words, the deliberate separation of one item of knowledge from all others and from all wider abstractions that could explain or clarify. The deliberate separation of one item of knowledge from all others, and particularly from all wider abstractions that would explain or clarify. It's the idea, you see, of making every item a separate watertight compartment without relation to the rest of knowledge. The refusal to connect one area or item of knowledge to another. And the basic cause, as far as rationalists are concerned, is this, to recapitulate. First, he has floating abstractions. Then he throws them aside with a fervent commitment to study one narrow point until he, quote, really gets it. And then he discovers that he can't get it, so he narrows his focus even more. And he ends up staring at a concrete bound point that he cannot get, and then another one and another one. Now, I'd like to give you an example to show you how compartmentalization is related to floating abstractions. It's the necessity of floating abstractions. And take this example. A man sees that the laws of the government are, let us say, ruining the oil industry. Now, that takes an intelligence to observe. And to this extent, if he really sees it, he has abstractions that are tied to reality, that are not floating. Government, that term, stands for something to him. Laws stands for something to him. He knows what laws he's talking about in regard to the oil industry. Oil industry stands for something. He knows what enterprises, etc., are involved. Now, let us say he comes to the clothing industry, or the medical field, or the banking industry, etc. And he wants to know, why are the laws passed by the government to control this field, why are they bad in this field, too? Now, if you tell him, in essence, well, look, controls as such create destruction in any industry, whether it's oil or medicine or banking or whichever. He says to you, in effect, and you must have heard this, that's too vague. It's too generalized. I mean, that's too empty. You can't talk, he says, about controls as such, because it depends what kind of controls. And you can't talk about industry as such, because oil differs from medicine, which differs from money, and so on and so. Now, you see, that is like a confession on his part. To him, controls as such is a floating abstraction, disconnected from reality. And so is industry. Industry as such, it's too broad. It's not connected to concretes in reality. And therefore, he experienced it as vague, generalized, empty. In other words, this person can keep his concepts tied to concretes up to a certain point. And beyond that level, he can't. His concepts start to float. Well, in order to function at all, then, he has to use his apparatus such as it is. And he's got a limited ability to focus. Everybody has, because of the Crow epistemology. There's only so much he can hold at any one time. He does not have the conceptual apparatus to tie X and Y industry into one unit. He can't grasp that the laws governing medicine and the laws mandating price controls in the oil industry come under one unit, namely controls. So he has no option, given his mentality, given the way he holds concepts, but to treat each of these industries as separate unconnected entities because he doesn't have the means to connect them. So in effect for him, the oil industry is one compartment of his knowledge. And the medical industry is another compartment. And if he were to write a book, he would have a chapter on oil without any reference to medicine, and a chapter on medicine without any reference to oil, etc. Now you see, all of us have to separate. We have a totality of experience. We can't just sit and stare at everything. We have to separate. We have to say, I'm going to focus on this and not on all the rest of it. But what is it that prevents a rational separation from being compartmentalization? What is the thing that prevents rational separation of concepts from being, of fields, from becoming compartmentalization? What's what? Well, realizing it and being able to connect what you separated back to the rest of your knowledge. And by what means do you connect? By means of broad concepts. But they will only function if they are not floating. If they float, they cannot serve to connect. So a compartment in this sense, in the bad sense of the term, you can think of it like this. A compartment is a separation gone bad. See, a separation is legitimate for specialized focus, but only on the premise then of reconnecting it to the total by means of abstractions, which are broad enough to grasp what's in common between it and the rest. But a compartmentalizer is somebody who simply can't do it. His concepts float, and therefore he has to break things up into a compartment and stare only at that. A rational mind separates when he does, always feeling this is temporary. It's important, he feels, a rational, not a rationalist, but a rational mind. It's important, he feels, to see the relationship, the connection between the separated element and the rest of what I know. But to do this, that requires broad concepts that actually are connected to reality. But the impaired or inappropriate approach here has no inner need to connect his separation, to complete it by connecting it back to the rest. To him, separation is just an end in itself. You separate out white lies and study them. And next week or next year, you study used car salesmen. And next month or whatever, you study another type. And it's just a number of types. So you study the coal industry or the oil industry or the medical industry. Or if you're not that abstract, you would never even get that. If you're a newspaper columnist, you study strip mining laws. Or you study strip mining laws in Tennessee. Or you study strip mining laws in Tennessee in 1981. Or you study foreign policy in the first half of the 20th century, or you study the invasion of Grenada, however it is, but that is your topic, and it's not just that you focus on it and then connect it, it's on principle disconnected from everything else. That is the compartmentalizer. And a rationalist is one of the real exponents of this. He demands certainty. His method doesn't enable him to get it. He decides I must know everything, and then he plunges in out of helplessness to start compartmentalizing. And he can't reconnect his compartments because his concepts all float. You see the paradox. Here is a rationalist who idealizes wide-scale vision, broad concepts, general theory, and he ends up, by the logic of his method, being a concrete-bound, disintegrated gazer at this item and this item and this item. He reaches the very opposite of his intention, and therefore the paradox is that in practice, in many cases, you cannot tell the rationalist from the empiricist. The empiricist is busy going around studying a disintegrated concrete opposite of his intention. And therefore, the paradox is that in practice, in many cases, you cannot tell the rationalist from the empiricist. The empiricist is busy going around studying a disintegrated concrete, and so is the rationalist. And the reason is, since he loves concepts, the rationalist, but he dissociates them from reality, and therefore he's helpless to deal with reality and is thrown back on, he has no alternative but to try to deal with it without concepts, which makes him concrete bound. So he's led to the opposite of his ideal by the unavoidable necessity of his approach. Let's take a break and we will continue this afterwards. All right, I want to continue with a couple of last points on the topic of certainty without omniscience. You can see, I think, pretty easily on this point alone why a rationalist is driven into mysticism ultimately. Concepts fail for him. They don't give him the understanding he wants. So he tries the perceptual level of being concrete bound. But the purpose of concepts is precisely to explain what you can't cover perceptually. So the rationalist is in this position. He wants to have a large-scale vision and understanding of reality. His concepts can't do it because they float. And his percepts can't do it because nobody's percepts can do that. So he ends up necessarily with the idea, I get this large-scale vision somehow, by some means other than percepts or concepts. If I study diligently enough percepts and enough concepts, somehow I'll have the illumination which transcends all of them. And all the major rationalists in history did exactly that. However much they were in favor of deduction from axioms, what the climax of their theory of knowledge was, you get a mystic vision, and that explains everything. Plato said that, Spinoza said that. It's throughout the rationalist tradition. Now, the people in this room would not, I'm sure, have a tendency to look for one all-encompassing mystic vision. You might, however, experience this point, this issue of certainty with omniscience. By constant swings on a given subject, and this would be a test, a kind of homey test, of whether you have a rationalist problem or not. Do you find on a given topic that part of the time some aspect of it is unclear to you, and you feel, I don't understand that subject at all. I'm simply ignorant. I don't get any of it. And then you get the answer to that one point, and nothing now suddenly looms in front of you as confusing, and you feel, I understand everything. This is completely clear to me. I know it all. And then a week or a month or a year later, some point comes up that you can't answer, or you forgot some point that you had known before, and you suddenly feel, I really don't get this topic. It's completely confusing to me. As is typical of a rationalist to swing from I know everything to I know nothing. Now, properly speaking, your attitude should be that you know what you know, even when you realize there are things about that subject that you do not know. For instance, if you know that capitalism is correct, and you know that in a reality-oriented fashion, you should not be shaken if somebody brings you some example from the 19th century that allegedly proves the evil of capitalism and that you can't answer. You do not have to be omniscient. You do not have to know the answer to every piece of concrete example or lunacy that someone could bring up to know your principle and why it is correct. But if you feel, when you hear the principle, now I know everything, and then 2 weeks or 2 years later when this example comes up, I don't understand it at all. I'm completely thrown. I don't even know whether capitalism is right. That is a rationalist idea. The goal is omniscience. So long as you feel you have it, you're certain. As soon as you don't have it, you're wiped out. In the moment of feeling omniscient, the rationalist feels, in effect, as though he's had the revelation. He knows everything. He doesn't need to specify, I know it within this context, up to this point, within this framework. None of that is relevant. He knows everything. He got the revelation. And then, as soon as he loses his conviction, it's gone altogether. I can't know. He becomes, in practice, a skeptic. So he alternates between a dogmatist who thinks he has the absolutes without any context, and then a skeptic who's uncertain. All right, let's go to point five. The concern with order or system, a very special kind of order or system. The concern with order and system. That, of course, is implicit in what we've been saying and in the very fact that mathematics is his ideal. Now, there is a certain virtue in this attitude. The rationalist detests chaos. He always goes in a step-by-step fashion. When you follow his thinking, you always know where you are. He's very organized. He's very methodical. He's very step-by-step. His thoughts are always systematically connected. And to this extent, that is good. That's a virtue. It's much better than just a hash of jumping from one thing to the other where you don't have any idea why. He's very big on logic, on structure, on order, etc. But he has, unfortunately, several vices on this topic. And first and foremost is the fact that the order that he cherishes is actually arbitrary, because it is detached from reality. His axioms, which are his cherished starting points, are themselves arbitrary. Out of context, he just plunges in wherever he feels like, such as in the Leibniz case of compounds require simples. And he just yanks out of them by force of deduction whatever he can, and the whole thing is a floating castle in the air. Consequently, you can say that he is a staunch advocate of order, but it is order apart from reality. It is not order dictated by the facts of reality. It's an order arbitrarily imposed on a world of concepts. So his order is artificial. And you can see that very clearly on the fact that the typical rationalist is obsessed with things like symmetry, neatness, which is like order apart from any reality reference. For instance, Kant. Now, Kant is a mixture of everything bad. He's a rationalist, an empiricist, an intrinsicist, a subjectivist, everything bad. But in this regard, he certainly is a rationalist. And if you know his critique of pure reason, he's trying to work out the a priori endowments of the mind. And he works it out. There's four sets of three each in each set. And he is going to have four sets of three absolutely no matter what. It would positively kill him if he were to have three sets of three and one of two. 11 categories would be out of the question. There's got to be three in each, and each of the three has to be a positive, and then a negative, and then a union of the two, which is where Hegel got his particular order of the dialectic process, you know, which is a thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. So he was another rationalist order without reference to reality, which he grabbed off from Kant, etc. All of these people, they have a definite structure, but it's completely arbitrary. And you can see that in this loving attention to neatness, symmetry. There has to be just the right number of divisions, etc. Now, that's one trouble with the rationalist concern with system and order. Now, there is another problem, quite different. Even though, in fact, his order is arbitrary, he doesn't recognize this. He experiences it as reality demands the particular order that he follows. He experiences it, in other words, as he has absolutely no choice in regard to the order he follows. There are no options as he sees it in a thought process, in a writing process, in any form of cognition. There's always only one definitive pattern that you must follow. So if you are writing an article, for instance, and you are a rationalist, it is simply anathema to you to feel, well, there's 10 different ways I could do this article. Every one as good as every other. That will simply gall on you. You'll feel, well, this is impossible. I want my article to be objective, you will feel. And that means I want it to be dictated by reality. And reality will therefore tell me, if I really study it conscientiously, the place to start is with X, that's the first point. And then from there will follow Y and Z, etc., etc. The whole thing is written by reality. The article, in effect, is out there. And all I have to do is look at the right features of reality and read them off, and that will dictate the structure. In other words, a rationalist is hostile or opposed to the idea that there's any option, any choice in a mental process, in a cognitive process, in a writing process. Now, again, to give you a personal example of this point, I know my own case, so to speak, best. I several times had the problem in writing early stages of the book of feeling I could not figure out an outline for a chapter. And an outline, as it stood to me in my mind, was a necessary structure dictated by reality where there was no option. I had that problem most acutely, for instance, on the chapter on Weimar culture, the culture of hatred, where I was covering art and music and education and literature, etc. And no matter how I wrestled with it, I couldn't think of a reason why. You had to start with art and then go to literature and education, or start with education and then go to youth movements. And there was absolutely no necessary structure. Now, in actual fact, these are all simply illustrations within the broad principle of a certain type of cultural situation. The whole chapter was inductive. It was generalizing. What is the culture, as you can see by looking at this concrete and this concrete and this concrete? And in induction, there's absolutely no necessity for a particular structure, a particular order. I remember discussing that chapter specifically with Miss Rand, and she said to me at one point, it doesn't make any difference. It's all just examples anyway. Choose whatever is most interesting to you, she said, or most eloquent in your opinion, or most dramatic. And of course, that absolutely scandalized me because I thought she's saying, in effect, well, be a whim worshiper. I said, well, I have to have a reason for finding it more interesting. Why should this be more interesting? Just because I find it more interesting, I have to prove that it really is most interesting. I mean, how can you tell me go by my emotions? In effect, you're going to make the whole thing subjective. You see, the order of a rationalist has to be a deductive order. Induction has no order, as he experiences, and that's another reason why he can't deal with it. Or put it another way, there's got to be a logic. He's very big on logic, but logic to him means if this, then this, if this, then this. And if it's simply a series of things on the same level, data which are simultaneous in reality, he's lost in thinking or in dealing with it. And I remember saying to Miss Rand, how can you possibly advocate such a thing? What would you have gone to Euclid and told him, start with whatever proposition is most dramatic? I mean, you would realize that that destroys geometry altogether. That makes it completely subjective. And I and rationalists take the idea on every subject matter, whether writing or thinking, you see, it should be like geometry. Reality has to dictate by itself, quite apart from you, your interest, your purpose, your knowledge, all of that is beside the point. Reality must dictate a certain order, and you simply have to mirror it, follow it, the order dictated by reality. Otherwise, it is subjective. That's why, for instance, when we did the hierarchical structure exercise, a rationalist would like the fact that there's a certain order, but he would balk at the fact that there are options. There are options, and you're wiping the whole thing out. Once there's options, that's subjective, we have no longer any objectivity. You see the idea, which I'm not going to use a word starting with I, but you see the idea that reality itself sets your mental process. That you have a theme is irrelevant. That you have a purpose is irrelevant. That you have interests is irrelevant. Something inherent in reality is the sole factor relevant. And you are supposed to simply mirror it with no contribution from you. Now you can guess what view of knowledge and of the relation of consciousness to existence underlies this, but I'm saving that for the climate. So we have this paradox that the rationalist order or system is in fact detached from reality, but he experiences it as dictated by reality. Let's see. What? The rationalist system is in fact detached from reality, but he experiences it as dictated by reality, by a reality beyond him to which his desires, his interests, his selfish concerns, his feelings are simply irrelevant. And therefore, it is very, very difficult to argue this point with a rationalist. If you try to explain to him that his order is arbitrary, unless you give him lecture after lecture and pound him, he says to you, I can't grasp what you mean by my order is arbitrary. It's dictated entirely by reality. It's deductively necessary. I contributed nothing to it. All right, let us go. I'm going on despite all sound systems. Let's go to point six. Which follows clearly from what we've said so far. Anti-emotion. A rationalist is anti-emotion. As soon as he hears the word emotion, he right away says, subjective. You're destroying everything. Don't bring that personality into the question. We want to be neutral, factual, impartial, objective, concerned only with reality. Emotions are out. They have no role whatever. No role in grasping the data, no role in organizing, no role in presenting. Desires are simply irrelevant. In other words, your interests are irrelevant because your interests are motivated by your values. And that is simply a quote, subjective in his point of view. So when you go to acquire knowledge, you eviscerate yourself of all interests. Personal concerns are simply irrelevant. You are supposed to be an empty mirror, mirroring reality. You have no feelings. If you have a personal interest, a personal involvement, that, of course, is going to distort. That's going to detach you from reality. That is wrong. And, of course, if you told a rationalist that there's a psycho-epistemological need to keep your emotional life alive in order to keep your abstractions concretized, the point that we've been talking about, he would simply be aghast at that. In effect, the way he puts it is, you have to follow reality however boring it is to you personally. You have to be selfless. Now, you know that in actual fact, if you are writing, if you are bored, That is an unfailing sign that you're doing something wrong, that you're trying to write something either that you don't understand or that your subconscious is not convinced is important. And that will stop you worse than any other thing. And the only way to get out of that is to stop and say to yourself, if you are really bored, what do you actually want to say? What actually interests you? And that, if you can get the answer, is what your subconscious, all the considerations integrated by your subconscious, which led to this desire, is what will enable you to write. Now, you may be wrong. Maybe what interests you is mistaken, and that's not relevant to your assignment, but you'll never know until you get it down on paper. You'll never know by saying, I can't go by what interests me, because then you simply stop yourself dead. But a rationalist feels to say, I want, is a confession of guilt. You're not supposed to say, I want. You're supposed to say, this is what is required. You simply have to repress. If you have a want, wipe it out, push it aside, get it out of there, because that is interfering with the neutrality of your presentation. You see, therefore, that selflessness, in the deepest sense of your interests, your values, your desires, your concerns, simply have to be wiped out, is inherent in rationalism. Now, I put it to you, therefore, you can project from the objectivist view of selfishness as a virtue that it has to, therefore, be pro-emotion. Not in the sense of emotionalism, but it has to be opposed to rationalism fundamentally. And I'm saying that because I'm, conducting a campaign in this course in favor of emotion to counteract a certain tendency. And here is one very important aspect that we are going to be elaborating when we get to the later lectures, particularly Lecture 10. Now, you can see, just to conclude this point about emotion, that a rationalist is actually ambivalent or inconsistent about emotions. Because on the one hand, he is repressed. He prides himself on being repressed. He thinks that's a virtue. He's anti-emotion. But on the other hand, in actual practice, how does he choose his alleged axioms? They feel right. So in actual practice, he's an arrant emotionalist. Of course, he doesn't admit that because he thinks he's getting it by direct revelation from true reality. But nevertheless, in actual practice, he's going by his emotions and he's not going by his perception. So as on so many of these issues, he's mixed. By having the wrong attitude, which he thinks he's doing in the name of virtue, he ends up falling into the vice. He's all for concepts apart from percepts, and he ends up being concrete bound. He absolutely shuns emotions, and as a result, he's an emotionalist. You see, you cannot get away with these one-sided distortions. And in order to function, therefore, in many, many ways, he ends up as the opposite of what he purports. Well, let's try to do. Can you take one more point? I'll do half of a point. And that'll just leave us a little for next time. A rationalist on polemics. A rationalist on polemics, I guess this is 7. Polemics, as you know, simply means the method of arguing with opponents. And the first point that to make here, and the only one I'll make tonight, is a rationalist feels a tremendous need to engage in polemics. He feels tremendously vulnerable when people disagree, and he feels as a result a tremendous passion to convince them, to change their mind, to get them to come around to his viewpoint. Why does he feel so vulnerable? Well, he doesn't feel secure about his own ideas. He's not really convinced, whatever his deductive structure, because in fact his ideas are floating. They aren't tied to reality. Hence, in his own mind, they seem shaky, which in fact they are. He can't therefore be content simply to present his ideas to someone else and let it stand or fall with their honest judgment. If you are secure internally in your own mind, you can tell your view to others and take the attitude, if you see it, fine. If you don't, that's your problem. But if you are insecure, if you feel shaky, and then they say, I don't see it, that is like a knife in the heart. You feel, I've got to coerce them. I have to get to them. I have to force them to accept it, to agree. I have to, in effect, hit them over the head with the QED. I have to beat down their criticism and come up with the unanswerable argument. Now, you see, on the direct level of sense perception, this doesn't come up. If somebody says to you, he doesn't see the table, you tell them, that's your problem. You say, look, there it is, you don't see it, that's tough. But for many people, if the question is life is the standard, or the evil of force, or the desirability of honesty, they do not see that as blatantly as they see here is a table. There's some fog in their own mind. There's some floating, there's some disconnection from reality, and therefore they feel threatened. They need to reduce the insecurity to batter down their opponents. And so they start constructing, if they take the rationalist way out, these allegedly impregnable proofs. Now, the motivation of these proofs varies depending upon the rationalist. But generally speaking, the purpose of the deduction is half to coerce others and half to convince himself. It's partly polemical and partly personal. Now, you see another reason here why the rationalist fears and dreads induction. You cannot coerce somebody by induction. You simply have to leave it to his judgment, to his honesty, to his knowledge, to his integration. You cannot give him 10,000 examples and say, therefore you must conclude this. All you can do is point out to him, here's the examples, here's the context, here's the indication of the integration. You go home and chew it now. You can't force it on him. But you see, by deduction, you can allegedly overpower the guy. You can get him to say, you see, if this, then this, etc., etc., therefore you must. And this is another reason why rationalists hate induction. It just doesn't work as a social weapon. Now, this need of the rationalist for deductive proof is often manifested in a multiplication of proofs. In other words, first a rationalist will give a proof of some point. And then, because of course his proof isn't really a proof, he's not satisfied. So he picks the proof apart and breaks it up into two more detailed proofs, taking some one sub-step and gives a separate proof of that. Or finds some new objection in a new proof to counteract that. He's like an engine constantly multiplying proofs. And it's like if you come back a year later or 5 years later, he's grown to this mammoth set of proofs, and he's still trying to construct new ones to close new things that have sprung up. It's like plugging holes in a dike, and there's this obsessive need to have proofs of the details of proofs, of the sub-details of proofs, etc. And it's a desperate attempt to armor himself against the fact that the court of last appeal is observation. And since that's no good, he's got to build these incredible structures. Now that was simply point one. the need of polemics, the insatiable need, never satisfied, to get out there and convince, coerce. The other point, which I'll put off till next week, is his distinctive method of dealing with opponents once he's decided to convert them. His method of attacking. And we will look at that and say some final words next time and then turn to empiricism. Thank you. All right. I've got a tremendous number of questions again, and I try to answer as many as I can. Is there really no proof for induction? Then how do we use it? I do feel comfortable using it, but I feel as though maybe I should not be if it isn't proved. Is this rationalist thinking? No. Induction requires a validation. That is not the same as saying it has a deductive proof. You cannot convert induction into deduction. You can't make it a species of deduction. It is something different. That doesn't mean that it can't be validated. And in fact, I'm going to say something about induction, something, in Lecture 9 to give an indication of how it would be validated. That is not the same, though, as equating proof with deduction. There is inductive proof and deductive proof. They can't all be reduced to deduction. Can you give an example of a philosopher giving up abstractions and focusing on concrete bound points? Isn't this anti-philosophy? Yes, certainly it is, but that didn't stop. The best example would be David Hume, who said you can know nothing but the sense perception of the moment that goes by you. Now, he was the arch-empiricist. He is to empiricism what Plato is to rationalism, the perfect Platonic example. But he thought all you could do is observe the little color patch go by. You couldn't even know that when it came by the next time that you'd seen it before, let alone get to such a wide abstraction as redness, or to such a thing as the cause of it, which was unknowable, etc. Bertrand Russell is an arch example. In fact, all of the modern analyst movement, which does nothing, which says in essence, integration is a mistake. Connecting anything to anything is a mistake. The only way we can know is to take some little item and focus on it out of context. So Bertrand Russell's famous in epistemology for a theory of the. That's it. That's. I mean, that's the level on which they operate. This question, I'm going to condense it, but it amounts to that you discussed three views, the intrinsic, the subjective, and the objective. One holds with reality but not consciousness, one with consciousness but not reality, one advocates both, and then it says, what view objects to both consciousness and reality? That's the only fourth possibility. And then the questioner suggests, would it be nihilism? That's as good an answer as any I can think of. Nothing exists. That would be like gorgeous in the ancient world. Skepticism, by the way, which this questioner also suggests, is not the same thing. Skepticism is an implication of subjectivism and is not the same as nihilism. Skepticism says we can't know, but leaves open maybe there is a reality, you see. Does intrinsicism always entail the belief? These are a lot of questions asked at the beginning of the class about last week's lecture. Does intrinsicism always entail the belief that knowledge is acquired independently of the senses without offering a rational explanation of this process? Does it always imply mysticism? An intrinsicist can accept certain sensory data, but to keep his good standing, he has to say it's not really important. It's just preliminary. It's partial. It's introductory. It's just on a low level. Really important knowledge comes directly from reality, not going through the senses. So in that sense, it really is the belief that the knowledge that counts is acquired independently of the senses. And it does, therefore, always imply mysticism, as I said last time. Yes, it does. Can modern philosophy, 20th century, be characterized as empiricist in content and rationalist in method? Yes, that I would think is a good summary formulation. They preach the slogans of empiricism, but in actual approach, they are completely rationalistic. Symbolic logic, the whole thing is a gigantic rationalistic construct invented by Bertrand Russell, the empiricist, and it's a whole series of incredible arbitrary rules for how to connect concepts together. And the whole of modern philosophy is extreme rationalism in its approach. On the basis of the material presented tonight, would you say that an empiricist is a rationalist at the terminal stage of intellectual helplessness? In other words, his floating abstractions have simply sailed off into the sky, and now he turns with vindictive vehemence upon abstractions as such. Well, I think there is a type of empiricist who reached empiricism by that means. They turned back and they saw. Empiricism is very often a reaction to rationalism. They saw what the rationalists did, and they have this floating world of concepts, and they say that's ridiculous, and they throw out concepts altogether. That would be Hume, for instance, in relation to Descartes. That would be the sophists in relation to the pre-Socratics as a common pattern. But it's not true that they really are that much the same, because an empiricist is a separate syndrome. They have many points in common, but we'll see when we get to it next time. There are still big differences between a rationalist and an empiricist. An empiricist is not simply a disillusioned rationalist. He may start that way, but then it takes on a life of its own. After reading Atlas Shrugged, I went on a quest to defend business because it was... because business was not differentiating whether it was ethical or not. Was this a symptom of rationalism on my part? Well, the only way I could imagine that it was a symptom of rationalism, you mean via the topic that you arbitrarily simplify and grab one thing out of it. If you did it for that motive, it would be mistaken. But as worded, I can't see that this is symptom of anything wrong, because if you want to argue or fight for a philosophy, you have to do it within the context of your knowledge, your interests, your goals, your situation. If you're a businessman and those are the issues on your mind, there's nothing in the world that says you should not take this as a big issue, which after all it is. So I don't see that point. Another one. When you referred to your early idea that everything can be deduced from the law of identity, were you referring to your doctoral dissertation? No, I was referring to an early version of my book. I have heard of some that prefer the dissertation to your recent work, The Ominous Parallels. The book, however, is more comprehensible. Is this due to your earlier rationalism? Well, first of all, a doctoral dissertation is not written according to any method. It is simply that which is required to pass a committee, of which unintelligibility is a prerequisite. So I was certainly more rationalistic in those days, but even that would not explain my doctoral dissertation. I can only say that my doctoral dissertation has some good ideas presented in such an incredible form that it is not worth finding out those ideas in that form. It's easier to make them up from scratch all over again. As to the idea, quote, some people prefer that to your book, The Ominous Parallels, I can only say that that type of preference would have to indicate an advanced degree of mental derangement. There's no other way. Well, here is a question with which, as I understand, is just a restatement of what I said, so I agree completely. Isn't the reason why the rationalist feels the need to deal with each concrete example precisely because he believes that the concept refers only to its definition? But he senses that the definition does not specifically refer to or subsume any concrete particular. His definition never leads him to concretes. Well, that is all true, and that's really the point I made. This is just a form of the general point that his concepts float, and therefore he feels the need to deal with concretes apart from concepts. That his definitions are disconnected from concretes is simply one example of the fact that his concepts float. So this is not incompatible with what I said. It's one aspect of it. Why can't the rationalist integrate across various compartments by simply deriving some definitions that subsume them all? Well, true, he certainly does that. The rationalist usually has, when he's on his abstract model, some broad abstractions or principles that tie everything together. But the whole point is they are unconvincing to him. So he is torn. On the one hand, he's a monist. So he has this one principle that theoretically explains everything. So if he heard me say you're compartmentalizing, he'd say that's ridiculous. I have deduced everything from the one or whatever it is. But on the other hand, since in fact the one doesn't convince him, in practice he actually compartmentalizes. So again, he's inconsistent by the nature of his problem. You said last week that all of parapsychology is based on the intrinsic approach. You also said that the question of the objective versus the subjective and the intrinsic arises with the issue of concept. How then can ESP, which is a theoretical way of perceiving, be based on the intrinsic method, which only arises with the issue of conceptual knowledge? Did you get that one? And my answer very simply is there is no such method as extrasensory perception. And my interpretation of it is based on that. I do not accept the idea of a form of perception outside of the senses. If I did, there would be no objection to it as intrinsic any more than to any form of perception. My whole point would be extrasensory perception is a contradiction in terms. The senses are the means of perception. Perception outside the senses is awareness without any means of awareness, and consequently is simply dismissible as such. And therefore, the way I approach extrasensory perception, they in fact, regardless of their claims, they in fact claim knowledge which is only reachable on the conceptual level. And therefore, it comes under this. They claim, for instance, knowledge of the future by precognition, which I would say can only be grasped by thought, by reasoning, by conceptual inference, not by perception. If they claim that knowledge, but without any objective method of argumentation, they are in fact accepting knowledge on the conceptual level without a means, and that is therefore intrinsicism. So, in other words, to put it simply, I do not accept their definition of it as perception. If I did, then it, of course, would not come under. So the question is right to that extent. Now we go all the way back for a moment. I tried to organize these, but some obviously got in here out of order. To a question on the use of force. And the question, you remember that? Can you go back there? The questioner says that he found the examples that I gave convincing, but he has an example which he doesn't think is as clear-cut. And how would we analyze it? A father witnesses the brutal murder of his daughter, but is unable to prevent the crime. He then goes to the police in accordance with the law. The criminal is brought to trial and is clearly guilty. However, on a technicality, he is free. This man, who has adhered to the principles of justice and never committed an unlawful act in his entire life, cannot bear to see this murderer walk away free to perhaps kill other innocent children. He kills the criminal. Has he abandoned his principle? No. I would say he has not abandoned his principle, not if you define what his principle is. There are two different principles involved here. One is the issue of force as retaliation versus as initiation. Now, if this guy, this criminal, actually committed the crime and the father is killing him as revenge or retaliation for that, that is obviously not initiation. That is absolutely not comparable to the issue of the used car salesman putting one over or any of the other examples that we analyzed. He is still on the premise of using force as retaliation, and therefore he is still adhering to his lifelong principle of justice. He is not in any way reducible to the other examples. But there's a different principle involved, which is not the one we talked about, a political rather than a moral principle, and that is, should you take the law into your own hands? Should you be the agent of justice, or should you delegate that to the government and let them be the ones who make the decision, including, if necessary, even the necessity to abide by a mistaken decision in a concrete case in order precisely to validate the principle that men will not appeal to force to resolve these disputes on their own. The whole idea of government is to make the recourse to force unnecessary. And since men are not omniscient, it's always possible in a particular case that the justice system will go bad, even in Atlantis, to say nothing of the way it stands today. That's possible. But if you accept the principle, as I do, of the necessity to delegate this in order to have objectivity in the use of force, then on that principle you could not take the thing into your own hands. So he would be violating that principle. But that is not in any way the same principle, and it is obviously much more understandable, even if mistaken. Now, if a father such as this killed this criminal, I would have a great deal of sympathy for him. I would feel it's a very understandable, even if misguided and mistaken, action. I would certainly not think it represented a tremendous flaw in his character or an evil or anything of that kind. It would be quite conceivable to me that he loved his child and he just simply lost the context and couldn't stand it, what struck him as a monumental injustice. I would say, however, he would have to be prepared to take the consequences in a case like that. If the person is legally innocent and he does them in, he can't say, well, I know, I saw, if in fact they've tried him and there's no way of doing it. So I would sympathize, but I'd still say he's mistaken. That is not an example, however, of the initiation of force. Do you get the distinction? Now, here's a confusion about intrinsicism. You said that consciousness has identity as against intrinsicism. As I understand it, intrinsicism merely says that consciousness is irrelevant to cognition. I don't see how this prohibits it having an identity. No, it does not say that. Nobody could say consciousness is irrelevant to cognition. If you didn't have a consciousness, there'd be nobody to know. So even intrinsicism grants you have a faculty of awareness. You have a consciousness, it's not irrelevant, but what is irrelevant is its nature. It contributes nothing except being a blank, indeterminate mirror. So the essence of it is not that its existence is irrelevant, but it has no identity. Now, here is another real confusion about intrinsicism. You spoke of the intrinsic nature of the Bible. Now, let's clarify that. Every book has a nature. So it's not true that every time you use the word intrinsic, that is intrinsicism. Atlas Shrugged has an intrinsic nature. There's so many pages, and so much paper, and so many words, etc. That has nothing to do with what we are here talking about. The intrinsic view is not that nothing has a nature, but that over and above the perceptual level, there are entities intrinsic in reality that act on our mind and cause knowledge or value judgments, you see. That doesn't mean that this lamp doesn't have an intrinsic nature or this cup, but they are perceptual entities. Now, so let's, obviously the Bible has a nature. There's nothing against the Bible. That's just the law of identity. But leaving that out, he says, isn't it true that within the same religious text, the Bible, there are the words an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth? I have two questions. Is this not the opposite of intrinsicism? Does this then represent religious hypocrisy? And second, since one seems to be, at least in certain cases, an alternative principle, then the pure intrinsic nature doesn't apply. Did you get that? You didn't get that? Oh. Well, he's saying, in effect, if I translate that into the way I would understand it, there are some good ideas in the Bible, so that, doesn't that mitigate the fact that it's, well, you can't say it's an intrinsic approach, because an eye for an eye, I gather he means, is correct, is a valid principle, so there are some good things in the Bible, so it's not all wrong. Now, this is a confusion as to what intrinsic means. Intrinsicism is an issue of method, not necessarily of content. The Bible can have individual points which are perfectly correct. There's nothing to say that in content, an intrinsicist always advocates wrong ideas. The point is he has no way of telling right ideas from wrong ideas, but sometimes he comes up with the right ideas. In general, it's certainly desirable not to kill, not to steal, not to lie, not to bear false witness against your neighbor, etc., and so on. Not every one of the commandments is wrong-headed. And the same for an eye for an eye. The point is this: what makes the Bible intrinsicist is that when you ask how is these commandments defended, what is their objective basis? It's simply God said so. And of course, as you know, God does not define a purpose, a context, anything like that. It's just, you know, that's it. And of course, how are we to know then an eye for an eye? Whose eye for which eye? How is this to be applied? In what type of situation? There is no guidance and no way to infer it from the Bible. So the intrinsicist form is there even for the valid content. But that doesn't mean that everything in the Bible is wrong. That's ridiculous. Does man's form of consciousness contribute categories to his conceptual form of awareness, like Aristotle's categories? Is there a specific set of categories, for example, substance, state, action, place, time, relation, etc.? No, I would say not. This is apropos of what does consciousness contribute? The so-called categories, as Aristotle presents them, pertain to the nature of reality, not to our method of grasping it. And consequently, they are not a product of consciousness. They are, as Aristotle presented them, the broadest abstractions applicable to anything which exists, the so-called summa genera. And that is not part of what consciousness contributes. Can you explain the difference between truth and fact? What is more fundamental, truth or fact? Obviously, fact. Fact is metaphysical. Truth is epistemological. Fact is any aspect of reality. Truth is our grasp of that, our recognition of that fact, and the correspondence of our thought to the fact. So the more fundamental is obviously reality, the fact. Would you say that a rationalist certainty in his ideas increases with the number of people he has convinced? I think that's entirely optional. It depends on what type of psychology he has. He may go by quantity, in which case the more he convinces, the happier he is. Or he may feel that the more he convinces, the more in jeopardy he is, because why don't they see all the flaws in his argument? So people are hopeless and he has no way of getting to reality independently, so the more he convinces, the more desperate he is. Or he may be attached to one specific subcult or subculture, and to him, It may not be important what the world at large thinks. He may go only by one or two authorities. So if the master is convinced, he can take with equanimity the masses because he just writes them off as ignorant. So you cannot, in other words, equate a rationalist with the kind of low-grade Peter Keating. It does not necessarily follow. Well, that's a question straight for lecture 12. If I don't answer them when they come in, even though they may be of general interest, I'm saving them, and someday, hopefully, I will get to them. In ethics is the so-called deontology versus teleology debate, an example of the false dichotomy between intrinsicism and subjectivism. Yes, that is a very, very good application if you are a philosophy major. Deontology is those philosophers like Kant who say there are certain absolutes that you must follow regardless of their consequences and apart from any goal to which they lead. And that is clearly the intrinsicist view. Teleology in ethics is the view that we validate virtues by reference to an ultimate goal, but that, the way most teleologists hold it, that goal is arbitrary. There's no way to validate the goal. You simply have to say, if you want to achieve it, follow this method of action, but if you don't want to achieve it, something else. So that comes out as being the subjectivist approach. Therefore, as these are commonly construed, they are exactly this dichotomy. Now, you could argue that objectivism is teleological in that it starts with a value, an ultimate goal, and validates everything by reference to that. So it repudiates the idea of thou shalt or thou shalt not as out of context absolutes. But today, teleology is almost completely dominated by subjectivists. So practically speaking, this is a good application that I did not cover in class. Trying to get a brief one. Well, take this as the last. He says last week, but this is about 5 weeks ago. You stated the context for honesty is life, principles, and rationality. Do the other virtues have different context, or is the application of the context different for each virtue? Well, they have this, all the virtues have the same basic context. Life, principles, rationality. But to some extent, you have to prepare each one differently because each one focuses on a different aspect of rationality. And so to set it up, you need a different focus. So you couldn't say the context is absolutely the same. For instance, if you turn to productivity, you will have to stress the relation of mind and body and the role of material values in human survival in a way that you would not have to for honesty. It would be implied. But that wouldn't be part of the immediate focus of your whole discussion the way it would for productiveness. Or if you turn to justice, you would have to focus on the relation of other men to you, why they are of value, why moral judgment of them is important, which is a very different type of consideration to what you would need, for instance, if you were going to validate honesty. So each virtue has, to some extent, its own unique nature and requires its own specialized context. But the basic context remains the same regardless of virtues, which one you're doing. Okay, I think we will stop here and pick up again next time. Thank you.